Les, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Hey, thank you for tuning in today on this June 11th, 2013. And here we go. It's all about food. And one of my favorite things about food is it can be really delicious and satisfying. So why not put all those pieces together? Make food taste great. Make it good for you. Make it gentle on the planet. Win, win, win. We can do it. And there's more people doing it now than ever before, and this is really the direction we need to go in. I always like to say that you do not have to be deprived when you want to take care of yourself, when you want to nourish your body, and you can be doing good things for our home, planet Earth, as well by eating a healthy, delicious, plant-based diet. Right? You know that. I know you know that. And now I'm so excited. I'm here in the studio in Manhattan with one of the greatest chefs in New York City, possibly on the planet. And we're going to be talking to him today, Eric Blauberg, with more than 20 years of experience. He's a renowned culinary expert and is known around the globe as a master chef and first-class restaurant consultant. He has brought his considerable talent and expertise to such acclaimed eateries as Manhattan's famed 21 Club, Colors, American Renaissance, The Ritz in London, and the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in Beverly Hills. And there's so much more about Eric, and we're going to be talking about that today. Now, I got to know Eric through my friend and author, Linda Long. She put out a groundbreaking cookbook a few years ago called Great Chefs Cook Vegan. And surprise, Eric Blauberg was one of the featured chefs in that book. So thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food, Eric.
Great to be here, Karen.
I want to say that you're very courageous for joining me here today. You know I'm a vegan.
Yes.
And it's very brave of you to be here. But you've mixed with vegans before.
Absolutely. It's at the top of my list.
Oh, he's smooth, isn't he? Okay. So let's just learn a little bit about you and how you fell in love with food and learned about preparing food.
Well, Karen, I got into this the cooking world back when I was actually 12 years old, and I started as a pot washer up in the Catskill Mountains. And I was so impressed and amazed by everything that was the energy that was going on in this particular kitchen. And I returned the next year, my summer off from school, and at that point I knew it was something I wanted to do. And I started getting involved in the cooking aspect of it and slowly got away from washing the pots. And
you moved up.
Yeah, I did. I moved up. And I love it. It's great. I love to cook, and I love to feed people.
You love to feed people. I always say that if I could, I would cook for the world. If I could. It's just not possible to cook for 7 billion people. But a lot of people say that if you could cook for them, they would eat better or eat more healthfully if they had someone there to prepare their food. Okay, so you love to prepare food. And do you think it's in your DNA? Is anybody in your family interested in preparing food? Or this was novel for you from the beginning?
No, my inspiration was my mom was a great home chef, and so was my grandmother. So I took a lot of interest in that, and that's what originally got me into the hotel. They said, "Hey, can you cook?" And I was like, "Yeah, I cook. I can wash dishes. I can do just about anything." So, and I thank my grandmother and mom for that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, so now you're a consultant, and you work with other chefs and restaurants.
I do.
And okay, so one of the things that I think is really important and something that you've gotten involved with is telling mainstream or chefs of conventional restaurants that a vegan entree or vegan dishes should be included in their menu.
Absolutely, and that's always at the top of my list of priorities. I go into existing restaurants and I go in and I make them work better, or I'll do startup operations and do the pre-opening and opening. of new venues, or I'll go into places that are having lots of difficulties and go in and turn them around. But it's very, very important to appeal to everybody. And vegans and vegetarians have always been put on the wayside, so to speak, in the past. I mean, that's been my experience with it. And, you know, I started touching base on all this back in the early 90s. And at the time, I was very young, but I thought it was very important to have different grains and different vegetables on hand. So when you got that occasional, back in the 90s, person that or guest that that asked for something vegetarian, that it was accessible. And I had it ready to go. And, you know, I was very happy to put it together. And then, you know, the thing about it is, you know, there are a lot of vegetables and grains and different products out there, but I like to be creative with it to make them feel super special. And
make the people feel super special, or the grains feel super special?
Both. I put a lot of love in my cooking, so absolutely.
Oh, that is such an essential ingredient.
It is.
You never see that in recipes.
Yeah, love and passion is what it's all about, and it makes quite a difference.
Now, my understanding of traditional culinary training, especially in France, is that the chef is the artist, and you are there to appreciate whatever the artist, the chef, has prepared. And this is changing more and more, especially here in the United States. We're individuals here. We're very demanding. And there are people with allergies and food sensitivities, and then there are the vegans. There are people with celiac disease. They can't eat wheat. There are people that can't eat nuts. There are people that can't eat this and that and eggs and a whole, every food out there, somebody's allergic to it. And this kind of plays in or makes it, changes that, that original concept of what a chef is supposed to do. Were you trained that you present your art, or that you're flexible, or a little of both?
A lot of everything, I'd have to say. And you're absolutely right. There are a lot of dietary needs out there and restrictions that people have. And, you know, typically, you know, sometimes it gets very complicated. Sometimes I have, you know, if I'm working back in a kitchen, that one of the waitstaff will bring a note in to me and hand it to me and say, this is what I can eat and this is what I can't eat. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's to the extent that, you know, people are, you know, as far as demands go. But, you know, typically, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, if somebody says you're allergic to this, that, and the other, that, you know, I always like to be on the careful side. So I basically tell them, you know, whatever we have, you know, what do you usually eat? And at that point, you know, this is what we have on the menu. We can pick and choose through this. I have, you know, special grains and things that aren't on the menu. What would you like? And I have them suggest to me. And then at that point, then I run with it.
Right. That's fun.
Yeah.
Now, you work with a lot of different restaurants, and this can't always be possible. Some restaurants have more flexibility than others. I imagine higher-end restaurants have more flexibility with ingredients than some that are pretty much spitting out some pretty set recipes.
Well, yeah. The restaurants that I work with, make sure that they understand that, and this is the restaurateur and the chefs and the people that I work with, that it's very important to listen to their customers' needs. So whatever it takes to, you know, to put together a dish or whatever, that it's important to bring those ingredients in. And those ingredients are, you know, they're not expensive ingredients at all. It's just keeping a little bit of this, that, and the other in-house, so you're able to put something like that together. Because as you mentioned, there are a lot of people nowadays that have all these dietary restrictions. So, you know, it's I make it certainly a priority to keep it in.
Now, you've worked all around the globe. I think I read somewhere that you worked at Chez Bocuse.
Yes.
And my listeners probably have heard this story before, because I shared it when Mitchell Davis of the Beard Foundation was on the show. But in talking about giving the customer what they want, I lived in France in the early 90s. It was a very different time, and I'm sure a lot of restaurants have changed since that time. But we had called Chez Bocuse 2 weeks in advance and said, can you feed a vegan? Can you feed someone that doesn't eat animal foods? And they said, sure, sure, in French, of course. Mm-hmm. Venez, pas de problème. And then a couple of days before we came, we sent a fax and reminding them. And when we showed up, I was the only vegan in the party, but when we showed up, they didn't know who we were. And every course was a disaster.
Oh,
and then
geez.
At the end, the maitre d' was trying to explain that there were like 25 chefs in the back, and of how could I possibly expect them to do anything like this? But did you get that impression from Bocuse and the restaurant that they made specific food and you didn't customize for the customer?
Well, I don't want to say anything about Chef Bocuse, but in that regard. But, you know, when I was there, it was, you know, basically to keep my eyes open and my mouth shut.
Yeah.
And,
certainly there's a lot of skill that I'm sure you picked up.
Oh, absolutely. It was very impressive. Frustrating at times.
Yeah.
But it was well worth it. So,
I would like to think that that style of food and that style of preparation at this point today could accommodate all kinds of food styles, including vegan. I know, I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Anyway, it was fun at the time, and it always makes for a good story. Now, I've eaten all around France and all around Europe, and I really haven't had a problem mm-hmm. like that. And in fact, most of the restaurants I had been to, high-end and low-end, without any notice, if you get to talk to the chef, they get delighted. Like, I will take this challenge.
Yes.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Right?
It is.
So what do you love about vegetables?
I love to prepare vegetables. It's certainly a challenge for a chef to take a simple ingredient like that and to turn it into a masterpiece. So you got to think out of the box. And as long as you have a variety of different things, then, and I use a lot of fresh herbs and I use a lot of spices to make the food taste good. And that's really important. So if the food, you know, looks like a masterpiece, it needs to taste like one too. So, you know, it's all about the flavoring. So you don't want it to be just steamed vegetables on a plate. That's mm-hmm. boring. And it's
Although
not satisfying.
I enjoy it sometimes, but that's not what you want when you go out and experience someone else's art.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Lots of shallots and onions and garlic and mm-hmm. olive oil and ingredients like that can make a difference.
A big difference.
Absolutely.
Okay, tell me about truffles. Eric Blauberg and truffles.
One of my favorite ingredients. I go truffle hunting at least twice a year.
Where do you go?
I go to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I go up to Alba as well as the Umbria region,
and we
hunt for truffles.
Okay, so let's start from the beginning. What is the fashionable truffle hunting attire?
Boots for the mud and a coat, usually. It's usually in the fall and winter is the best time for the truffles. And, a jacket and get ready to get your hands dirty.
And do you take any animals along to help sniff them out?
Yeah, absolutely. In Italy, they use dogs. And in France, they use dogs and pigs as well. But I haven't seen any pigs in Italy.
Hmm.
So
okay.
makes a lot of sense.
And then when you make a big hunt, do you hang that mushroom on the wall or something?
what
do you do with your treasures?
They put it in a bag, a paper bag. And, they get it back.
Can you bring them back to the States with you?
Not legally. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we'll skip that one. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's quite an ingredient. It really is.
And I've read lots of different things about importing truffles and how you may not be getting what you think you're getting.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of different varieties of truffles out there, and a lot of imposters is what I call them.
Yeah, and, how do you know?
Well, I know as a chef, I know what to look for just because of my experience. And there are a lot of tricks that people do. They take those Chinese truffles and they soak them in truffle oil, and truffle oil is typically an essence of truffles that's combined with oil, and it's very potent and has a lot of fragrance to it. So when they soak the truffles in it, it picks up the smell of the truffle, the scent. And, the only way to really tell is to cut it open. And I've had a few come in to me, truffle salespeople in the past, and where they were Chinese truffles, because I could smell them even before they opened the bag. I knew they weren't real because the scent was too strong on them. And then when I poured them out to look at them, and you know, I said to the one guy, I knew what he had in his hands. I said, "Hey, let me take one and cut one open, and if it is what it is, then I'll buy them from you." And he refused to let me cut it open, so I chased him out the door.
So the salesmen know what they're selling.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just such an expensive item, so there's you know, it's, you got to be careful. You spend a lot of money for it, and you want to make sure that you're getting the right product.
And what is so wonderful about truffles?
Well, it's the texture. I mean, it's a luxury food. It's one of the rarest ingredients in the world, so the price is high. And, you know, it has a firm texture to it, and it has a very distinct flavor. And the white truffles are typically, you don't actually cook with the white truffles. It's a finishing product. So if you make a dish, whether it's a vegan dish, and you slice up some white truffles over the top, you don't apply heat to the truffle. Now, the black truffle, there's a winter black and there's a summer black. Now, the most desirable is the winter black. And you can tell it's a winter black not only by the season, but when you cut it open, the inside of the truffle is black with white veins. That's a black winter truffle. A summer black truffle, when you cut it open, it's just the opposite. It's white inside with black veins going through it. So, but the more desirable in the black is the winter. And the black, you can apply heat to it. So that's the difference between the two. And the white is more expensive as well. But they're both great.
Right. And mushrooms in general are really good for us, and even the simpler ones have lots of wonderful flavors.
That they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's our meat.
There you go.
Yeah. That's our vegan meat. I want to talk about your food soon, but I want to save that, the best for last. And there's a lot of stuff going on television when it comes to food, all the Food Network shows and Bravo and Top Chef. And it seems like anybody can be a chef these days. What do you think about that?
I think it's pure entertainment. It's what it is. So
that's right, pure entertainment.
A lot of hype.
And I know I love to cook. I don't call myself a chef, but I like the food that I make, and I make food at home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, though, certainly I can be efficient and prepare some dishes very quickly, but especially when I'm making a dinner for people, I really like to get into the zen and take time to prepare my food. And yet some of this entertainment that goes on, the Iron Chef and Top Chef and stuff, a lot of it has to do with speed. And I don't know. I know in restaurants you have to put stuff out quickly, but does it kind of contradict with the art of making great food?
That is a great question, and yes, it does contradict.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, when we talked about love and passion that you put into your cooking, yes, it takes time to do that, to create that dish. If it's a simple dish and, you know, it's a vegan offering and you have some cauliflower in this particular dish, you want to cook each thing differently. I mean, that's what I do. And then even if you combine them in the end, they all have their own distinct flavor, and that's what love and passion is all about. You take that cauliflower and you put it in a pan with some hot olive oil and you cook it off and you roast it and you get that nutty flavor and you caramelize the outside of it, releasing its natural sugars and then your fresh herbs and whatever, and you do each vegetable separately. It makes the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't always get that, even if you're paying a lot, if you're pressed for time.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's about being organized, too. And when you're working in a restaurant, that you're organized with these ingredients. And yes, it can be done. So it's all about preparation. You know, I go into some of these restaurants that are doing pre-openings and it's like, well, how do we do this, chef? How do we do it? And it's like, relax, I'll show you. This is how it's done. You know, you don't do it in one day. You know, you build up to it. You know, you put your sauces together and you do your spice mixes and you get all that stuff ahead of time. You prepare it, and you just need to organize yourself. So, yes, we can do it, and I will show you how is how it's done. So,
I like that. But, you know, that's true in restaurants, and it's true at home.
Yes.
I'm always telling people to find their kitchen and start making food, and a big important piece is being organized, having all the ingredients. I might go a little too far with how I've got everything organized in my apartment with ingredients, but I want to know I've always got everything.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. You know, and it starts with a menu. You create the menu first, and then from the menu you create the shopping list, and then you make sure you eat before you go in to do your shopping.
You said you've been creating menus for vegans since the 90s. So what were some of the early dishes, and how have they changed over the decades?
Well, some of the early dishes, I used to put together tasting menus as well as an a la carte menu. And tasting menus are, let's say, five courses, and they're all different items, you know, from different categories. And always a treat was to have on my menu was a vegetarian tasting menu, whether it was, you know, a simple dish starting off with steamed artichokes with a tomato tapenade, and then the next course, celery and potato and carrot mousseline and a shareable spinach sauce, and next up, lentil stew spiced with cumin and crispy rice dosa, and then onto desserts and, you know, simple things, poached forelli pears
simple
with champagne with, and granite. And yeah, it's just about, you know, being creative.
Yeah.
Putting some love behind it. So.
Now, those were the earlier ones. Has your style changed at all?
Yeah, I think, you know, now I'm into the truffles and, you know, more of the luxury items, you know, to top off, you know, what I've been doing. And yeah, it's, you know, you as you move along and you learn and you know, through your creating dishes and stuff, then you become more creative with the dishes, whether it's presentation and maybe adding a few extra ingredients and deleting a few and whatever. But yeah, it's evolved, definitely.
Now, I believe that most chefs get into the business because they love to make food and they love to feed people. And where I come from, I like to add a few more parameters in that equation of wanting to be a chef and feeding people, providing delicious food, but also making food that is good for us.
Yes.
Making food that is not cruel to animals. Or even people, and that's a challenge because the people that are harvesting, growing and harvesting our food today, very often they're not treated very well. And food that the growing of it doesn't create an imbalance on the planet in terms of using up resources or polluting. And are we going to see this? I would like to see this. Ultimately, as all the important factors in people that are studying the culinary arts. You think it's happening? Is it a trend? Are people moving in that direction?
Well, it's all about putting the message out there. You know, it's such a crime to see the way things are industrialized and how farming is, you know, taken a certain direction. This has been going on for some time now. And, you know, I think that, you know, if we keep you know, I think it's really up to all of us is what it's up to, because if we stop buying those products, then those products will eventually go away. They'll go out of business. So, you know, it's the feedlots and, you know, if I'm away from the vegan thing, but buying meats and stuff, you know, grass fed, you know, farmers that are taking care of the animals the way they should be taken care of, and they're not cruel, and, you know, it's, you know, that's important. You know, the same thing with everything that's going on. You know, stay away, go back to our roots and the origin of those vegetables and the heirlooms and all that stuff. It's a little bit more expensive, but I think that once all that industrial stuff goes away, it'll even out, because there'll be more people involved in doing this type of farming and processing our foods, that it will certainly change. It'll change the world. So I think it's up to us to work on that.
A lot of us, when we have an image of a chef, like a stereotypical cartoon image, it's usually someone who's on the plus side, large.
Mm-hmm.
And we think, you know, a good chef has got to be that way because he's eating all this great, rich food. I'm looking at you, and you are stunning. You're fit and slim. And the chefs that I want to work with are the ones that look good, you know, and are taking care of themselves. Any comments?
That's funny. Ivana Trump once said that to me at a dinner. She said, my mother said, never trust a skinny chef.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
So, but no, it's important. I mean, I work around food, and I'm, to be honest with you, I'm not hungry while I'm working around it. It's when I walk away from it is when I become hungry. You know, and, you know, it's important to take care of yourself. I try to eat right and do the right things. So, you know, that I think that certainly adds to, you know, to your health. which is very important.
It is, and you're going to have a lot more energy to do more of what you want to do if you're eating right. And you can eat well and eat a lot of interesting, great foods and still maintain your girlish figure.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's so much you can get out of the plant-based products these days. So you don't have to worry about the protein and all. It's all there.
It's all there.
It's all there.
Yeah.
So, you know.
People need to know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in Linda Long's book, Great Chefs Cook Vegan, I remember you had some really lovely dishes in there, and one of them was this asparagus, green and white asparagus dish. It was like an aspic of sort, or like a tureen. It had agar in it.
Yes. What I did was I took the white and green asparagus, which were organic, and then I took some of the white asparagus, and I cooked, steamed them off. And I added some shallots and some different herbs to it. And then I pureed it. And that was basically, it was almost like a soup. And then I added the agar to it to thicken it up. And I just, again, it's about putting love and passion behind what you do. And I laid the asparagus out in a tureen mold. And I basically poured this soup, so to speak, over the top. And I lined it with truffles and a little bit of opal basil, which is a purple basil. That was my tureen. And I let it set up in the fridge, and I sliced it and then set it onto a plate with some flavored oils, and it worked well.
It's gorgeous, and I think it's probably the most creative dish in the book.
Oh, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Very kind of you.
Okay, so we just have a few minutes left. What are you working on these days?
Well, the big thing out there is all these craft beer venues are happening now, and you know, it's about, I'm working on tuning up a lot of different operations and making them work better. And, you know, the way the economy is now, it's important, again, to listen to your customers' needs. So I've been working on that mostly, getting the message out there.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, but the economy is a really important piece of the whole culinary world, especially with restaurants. And it's so hard to make a restaurant work, and it's even harder in this particular climate, but probably not as hard for the high-end restaurants.
Well, I think the fine dining thing is definitely on the slower side these days, and people are into, okay, let's call it fine dining, but it's more on the casual side. And again, it's more challenges for the chef, because now price point is definitely a big issue and a factor in the success of a restaurant, and also of the customer that goes into, you know, to buy this food, that, you know, you have a price point that works for all. And I think it's important that, that it's there. So, and then a chef becomes more challenged, because now he has to be more creative to create these very special dishes at a lower price point.
So before we end the program, I want to get back to chefs including vegan options on menus so that everyone can have something to eat in a restaurant, whether they're vegan or not. Are there any chefs that you work with that are really resistant to that idea?
I find it more with the restaurateurs. It's like, well, why do we have to put that on the menu? Can we take the word vegan off? And my answer is absolutely not. There are a lot of vegans out there, and just wait and see what happens, you know, once we do put it on the menu. And the Highline Ballroom was here in Manhattan, was one of my venues. And I went ahead and I did a vegan dish on there. Actually, I did several. And they didn't really expect that anything would really happen, that it would really sell. And I did one of the items. I did a very simple. It was a vegan burger. It was all handmade with all these really special ingredients. And I put it together, and it actually outsold all the meat burgers.
Woo!
And they were so impressed by it. And after that, all of a sudden, they wanted three more other vegan items on the menu, and they actually created a vegan section.
Look
on the menu.
That.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's so important. And you'd be surprised. There's a lot of people out there that are very, that want to eat healthy. So, and it's important that the restaurateurs and the chefs, they comply with that and they give people what they want. It's important.
Well, I think one of the things that scares people about healthy eating and vegan eating is that they're not going to get the flavors and the foods that they're used to and that what they want. And you're doing a wonderful job at showing people that that's not true. And they can eat healthfully. They can eat deliciously. And thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. No, it's my pleasure.
And sometime I hope to be able to have you over and cook for you.
Okay.
How's that?
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you, Eric, for joining me today on It's All About Food. And I'm really so glad you're out there. And we're going to take a break now. How about that? And we'll be back in a minute or two with Gene Bauer, the co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. Everybody, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And this is the second part of our June 11, 2013 program. Are you hungry after all that talk about delicious food? Actually, I'm not too hungry yet, but I got some good ideas from that last portion of the program. And I love eating healthy, delicious, plant-based food because it is so good. All right, next up, I'm very excited about this, Gene Bauer from Farm Sanctuary. He's the co-founder and president of Farm Sanctuary, America's leading farm animal protection organization. Gene has been hailed as the conscience of the food movement by Time magazine. For 25 years, he has traveled extensively, campaigning to raise awareness about the abuses of industrialized factory farming and our cheap food system. His book, entitled Farm Sanctuary, Changing Hearts and Minds About Animals and Food, was published by Touchstone in March 2008 and has appeared on the Los Angeles Times and the Boston Globe. How are you doing, Gene? Welcome to It's All About Food.
I'm great, Karen. How are you doing? It's great
Good.
To be with you.
Where are you today?
I'm here in the D.C. area, which is where I'm based, but I do travel a fair bit. I'll be up in New York this weekend and then I go out to California a little bit later in the month.
Great. Well, I want you to relax this next half hour. You're in safe territory. This is Vegan World here on my show. I won't be asking you where you get your protein. You talk a lot during the year. I understand you travel all over and give a lot of different talks. And my first question is, has that presentation that you give, has it changed over the last quarter of a century?
A lot of the basic information is still the same.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that animals are being mistreated on factory farms and that citizens can make a choice not to support those industries by shifting to a whole foods plant-based diet. So that's the primary message that I keep hammering, because it seems, you know, it's as far as I can tell, it's the truth, and, you know, it's the same. Now, things have made, there have been some changes over the years in terms of the industry. We've been able to pass some laws to ban some of the worst cruelties, so that's positive news. There has been more awareness about factory farming, and there's a growing mainstream opposition to the inhumane treatment of animals on farms. There's a growing recognition of the benefits of plant-based eating. So we have a lot of positive things in place in terms of attitude and awareness. And we also have the internet now where people can share information and see videos of factory farms, for example. And they can also get recipes for vegan food. So there's a lot of good information available. Those are all the good things. The bad thing is that we still have a massive infrastructure that supports industrial animal agriculture that includes tax breaks from the government and support from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have our school system that is still not doing as good a job as it should be of creating healthy habits in children, although there's a couple of schools now that are promoting Meatless Mondays or doing vegetarian cafeteria, so there's some progress there. But by and large, you know, meat eating is still the norm, and it is something that is not addressed in a very thoughtful way, unfortunately. And so the kind of mindless consumption patterns continue, and that's what we continue speaking out against. and encouraging people to make more thoughtful, more healthful, more humane, more sustainable food choices. And I think that's where the change is going to happen, is in the marketplace.
Yay,
we've been able to pass some laws, but at the end of the day, agribusiness depends on consumers to buy their product. When we stop buying meat, milk, and eggs, and anything from these cruel industries, they will have to shift. And that's starting to happen a little bit right now.
So I imagine over the last quarter century of talking to people, you've been inspired by some of the good things that are happening, but being a broken record, saying the same thing over and over, it's just amazing to me how over time people still don't know or still don't want to know and still ask the same questions. And in some ways it makes me feel like we're all mindless robots running around because we ask the same questions when we're posed with a certain concept. All programmed.
We are programmed, and we're bombarded with certain messages, you know, for years and on a regular basis on television and the radio, and these become a belief system. So, you know, we grow up being told that you need to eat meat to get protein. And that's absolutely not the case, but it's been said so many times for so many years through the media. And then parents say it to their children, who then say it to their children and say it to their friends. Even doctors are misinformed about nutrition, and they get a lot of their information from the pharmaceutical companies, who kind of have an interest in people buying their products, you know, such as heart medication. So we have an institutional systemic problem, and it is one that takes some energy to break out of. You know, most people go along with the majority. We are social animals. We tend to do what those around us do. And unfortunately, the majority of people still consume animals in this country, still think that we need to consume animals, you know, or that consuming animals is healthy somehow. So those are the beliefs. And the fact is we can live and do very well without eating any animal foods, including dairy products. You know, one of the things that the dairy industry has the public believing is that we need to drink cow's milk in order to get calcium so we don't get osteoporosis. And that's absolutely not the case. In our country, we drink a lot of cow's milk, and we also get a lot of osteoporosis. So that's clearly not preventing that problem. So, you know, we have some myths that we grow up with and we act on, and I think we just need to be open-minded and be willing to think of things in a different way and be willing to go against the mainstream, which is what needs to happen if somebody wants to adopt a vegan lifestyle right now.
You know, I think we have some things in our favor these days. So there are more people that have been vegan for a long time, more of us. And some of us in our 40s and 50s, I recently turned 55, we're feeling good, we're looking good, while our peers are looking pasty and pale and are having joint pains, knee pains, shoulder pains, all kinds of pains. And I think it's becoming clearer on an individual basis why this diet is so good.
That is absolutely true. The proof is in the pudding, and people are starting to recognize that now and take notice of these vegans who are doing very well health-wise.
Right. And take Gene Barr, for example, okay? I saw a little video. You were on KTLA recently in Los Angeles. You looked fabulous.
Oh, well, thank you.
You looked fabulous, and the co-host did not look as good. And, I mean, you can just see what a testament it is to the great nutrition that plants provide. And I noticed that you were recently interviewed in Runner's World last month.
That's right. That's right. I was in Runner's World in the May issue. I was in the I'm a Runner feature. And I've done three marathons in the past year, and I qualified for Boston at all three of them. So, and the last marathon I ran in Los Angeles, I was in the top 3 percentile for my age group in terms of the time I finished in. So, you know, as a vegan, you can do pretty darn well. And I'm now in the process of training to do an Ironman triathlon later on this year. Just again, demonstrating that vegans can do fairly well in the athletic field.
Well, there's another myth. A lot of people believe as they age, life is just going to go downhill and our bodies aren't going to work for us and we're going to feel worse and worse. And I like to think we're not getting older, we're getting better.
I think that's a very good attitude, and I agree with it. You know, the way that, you know, to think that our bodies are going to fall apart and are not going to take care of us causes us to not take care of them, actually. And I think we need to be very mindful. We need to pay attention to our bodies and feed them properly, move them, exercise them, and just listen to our bodies and be mindful of the consequences of our choices, whether it's how we eat or, you know, whether we exercise or not. So you know, getting older is not does not necessarily lead to us suffering more, as is oftentimes assumed.
You have done a phenomenal job educating the public about what is wrong with our food system and what's going on with animal agriculture, and I have to thank you over and over for that. You have touched so many souls and made such a tremendous difference. And while that happens, there's this great pushback between the animal agriculture industry and corporations that want to sell us unhealthy stuff. And we continue to hear a lot of distractions about issues that are really ridiculous. And there was one on that KTLA program when I watched that video where they were talking about, is veganism the new anorexia?
That was amazing, yeah.
I mean,
that was even...
And that's nutty.
Mm-hmm.
It's such,
that is nutty.
It's so, you know, they just want to go for sensationalism and things that make something that is so good, eating plant foods. You cannot connect that with somebody who's not eating.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, I think it speaks to the fear that people have, the fear of change. And so we just need to be able to demonstrate that living in this way makes sense, that it's healthy, and it's good for you. And I think making this lifestyle attractive is also very important, as I'm sure you know, too. And so I think there are some misconceptions out there, and there's fear, and those are some of the main things that we have to be able to confront. And we can do that by being supportive of any positive change somebody makes, or if they're starting to look into these issues. And when certain strange questions come at us, like happened when I was on KTLA, and we just, I think, have to recognize that it's coming from a place of fear, and that, you know, these people have been bombarded with certain messages and have prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a general prejudice against this idea that you can live well as a vegan, you know, given the mass marketing of the meat, dairy, and egg industries in our country.
Well, the fact that we are a fat society, more and more people are overweight, some are obese, and some are just plump. But plump is like the norm, so that when you see someone who's fit and slim, I've heard a lot of people say, you're too thin.
Right. Bad becomes normal. And, you know, I have not been to a doctor in many, many years, and I figured a few years ago I was in my late 40s, and I should go to the doctor just to make sure everything was fine. So I went to the doctor, and everything was fine. But the doctor asked me what if I had any heart disease in my family. And I told him that my father had a heart attack. And one of the first things he said to me was, well, I might want to put you on heart medication,
yeah.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, so that's the norm, which is crazy. So I left that doctor. I went to another doctor and basically just had him take my blood and ask him, you know, what does it look like? He said, everything's in the normal range except for one category is outside the normal range. And that category was the bad cholesterol, and it was below the low normal. So,
right.
So these numbers start getting skewed up, and I think that, you know, cholesterol numbers and so on have been adjusted to sort of fit our population profile, which maybe isn't the healthiest profile.
Correct.
And so bad becomes normal, and that's what we're dealing with.
That is correct. You know, I just want to add here that just because you're vegan does not mean you're invulnerable, and nobody gets out of this world alive. We all have a certain lifespan, and then the game is over. So while we're here, we should be having a great time, experiencing joy, enjoying our bodies, and being and feeling good as well as we possibly can. And that's where plant-based foods really can kick in and make the difference. I know I had a personal health crisis how long ago now? 2007 years ago. Time marches on. I had advanced ovarian cancer, and I was a vegan. And I've kind of figured out to myself how this happened to me, but what is very clear to me is my diet kept me alive for decades. I was living with a problem and didn't really acknowledge it, and it also kept me alive through my treatment, and now I'm thriving. And that's the power of plants. It doesn't mean that problems are not going to arise, but when we're feeding ourselves with great nutrition, it's going to really improve our odds of doing well and feeling great.
That's absolutely the case. And like you say, we're all human. We're all vulnerable. We will all die. But how our bodies perform and how our lives play out is very much affected by what we put into our bodies. And if we're putting in toxins, if we're putting in, you know, animal foods that our bodies cannot properly digest, if we're putting in foods that are laced with antibiotic-resistant bacteria and various other pathogens, that's only going to have negative impacts. So eating healthy food that is clean, that allows our bodies to function at the best level they can, you know, is good across the board. It also strengthens our immune system so that when we do have various challenges, that our bodies are best equipped to fight those off. So it's, but like you say, we're human beings and we all have various issues that we deal with. And at the end of the day, we're going to all of our bodies are going to end up going back into the earth. But while we're here, while we're breathing, while we're alive, I think we want to thrive and live as well as possible. At least that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and be nice to everything else around us, everyone and everything. Let's talk a little bit about Farm Sanctuary and where you are today. Now, you're in D.C., and I know Farm Sanctuary has gotten more involved in dialogues with our government.
Yeah, well, we have for a long time tried to pass legislation to ban some of the worst cruelties that happen on factory farms, and we're still involved in that process. So we've worked on state laws, we've worked on federal laws, but whenever you're working on legislation, you know, frankly, you're going to get fairly modest improvements.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll keep doing that. We think it's important. We think it's important to be involved in the process and for citizens to be involved in the process as well. But we also do a lot to educate people about the fact that we can live and be healthy with eating plant foods and not eating animal foods. So we educate people about the benefits of plant-based eating. And we have three sanctuaries where we take care of farm animals who have been rescued from horrible abuse situations. In some cases, we found living animals that were thrown away in trash cans or discarded on piles of dead animals. So we rescue those animals and take care of them at our sanctuaries, one in upstate New York and one in Northern California and one down near Los Angeles, California. And so these sanctuaries are places where the animals are our friends, not our food. They're places where people can come visit and connect with cows and pigs and turkeys and chickens and sheep and goats and get to recognize them as living, feeling creatures. And at Farm Sanctuary, the animals are seen very much like other people see their cats and dogs. If they're sick, we get the veterinarian out to take a look at them. And they get to live out their lives. They get to enjoy their lives. And it's a beautiful place. It's a sanctuary for animals and a sanctuary for people. And we invite people to come visit. And we model a different kind of relationship with these animals, one that is based on compassion, as opposed to the model that you see on factory farms, which is a callous disregard for the animal's basic welfare. And on factory farms, you're seen as commodities. At Farm Sanctuary, these animals are our companions. And I think most people, when they look at those two different worlds, would rather live in a world where the animals are our friends rather than where the animals are being abused.
I know I would.
Yeah, I think most people do. Most people are humane. Most people are humane and don't like cruelty. But unfortunately, most people are unwittingly supporting cruelty by consuming animal foods. And so then you have this disconnect and you have this dissonance between people's empathy and their compassionate values and their actions, which do not support empathy and compassionate values. And as a result, when we talk about factory farming, people oftentimes say, don't tell me, I don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's upsetting to know what is happening, and most people are appalled by it and don't want to be part of it. So rather than changing, you know, because people are very afraid of change, they just say, don't tell me, I don't want to know. And I don't think that's a very good answer. I think that we need to take responsibility. We need to look at what we're doing, look at the consequences of our actions, and then make choices that we can feel good about.
You brought up fear, and that's such an important concept, and it impacts everything we do, positive and negative. But when somebody says, I don't want to know about that, what do you say to them? Is there a way to get through to them when they specifically say, I don't want to know?
You know, I think different people are going to respond to different types of messages. But, you know, I would ask them, why don't you want to know? You know, and ask, you know, respond with a question. And they'll say, I don't want to know because it's upsetting. Well, why is it upsetting? Because I don't like what they're doing to the animals. Why don't you like what they're doing to the animals?
Right, good.
Because these animals have feelings and they suffer.
They know.
So I think most people actually, when they examine their conscience, will come to recognize that, you know, this is a system that is inappropriate and is outside the bounds of acceptable conduct, and that ultimately we should, you know, it should be changed. But it takes time, and old habits take a while to change, and people are scared of change. So, you know, we just have to be patient, but we also need to be persistent and firm in our position and straightforward about what is happening. But I think we also need to be understanding that for a lot of people, they're frightened and they don't know what to do. I think that's one reason also people say, don't tell me, I don't want to know, because they don't think they can change. They feel disempowered.
Mm.
They believe they need animal foods for protein or calcium or whatever, and they also believe that eating plant foods is very difficult. And neither of those is true. You can get everything you need from plant foods and no animal foods, and it's getting easier and easier to eat a completely vegan diet. And so this idea that it's difficult is another of those myths. And so there's lots of vegan food available, and it's getting easier than ever.
And what do I say on It's All About Food all the time? I say, you don't know how good you can feel until you do it. You just
there
don't
you go.
Know. And
that's
it feels
true.
Good, yeah. Okay, Farm Sanctuary has a walk for farm animals?
That's right.
Tell
Every
me about
year,
it.
Yeah, in the fall, we have a walk for farm animals, and we even have a website specifically to this program called walkforfarmanimals.org. And thousands of people around the country gather together to walk in support of protecting farm animals and supporting Farm Sanctuary's work. This is a great way to raise awareness and to raise funds, to reach out to your friends and your family and your coworkers and encourage them to become engaged and aware of these issues as well. So it allows us to reach more and more people every year. And we have walks going on in about 40 cities this year. And
wow.
If you go to the website, walkforfarmanimals.org, you can see if there's a walk in your area, and you can join it. But even if there is not a walk in your area, you can still get involved. So just check out the website, and hopefully, you know, people who are hearing this will want to get involved and be part of the solution to this massive problem that needs more attention.
Now, most people, the ones that are afraid or the ones that are afraid of change specifically, will say, I have a busy life, I don't know what to eat, and you're on the road all the time. So how do you do it? You look great. You're running and training for an Ironman, and you're on the road. What are you eating, and where do you get it from?
Yeah, well, you can go to grocery store and get fruit, you know, apples or bananas, for example. That's pretty easy to do. Or nuts and raisins. I'll have those fairly frequently. I stay at my parents' when I'm in L.A., and they usually have oats, and I just take oats with soy milk or almond milk or some kind of non-dairy milk. That's very easy to do. Oatmeal. You can get oatmeal at restaurants all over the place. You can get the burritos at some fast food chains or other restaurants. You get a bean burrito with no cheese. That's an easy vegan thing to get. You get spaghetti with marinara sauce, you know, no meatballs. Maybe they can throw some veggies in there. you know, just being a little bit creative works, and it's getting easier and easier. You know, it used to be that for soy milk back in the 1980s, you'd have to mix a powder with a water to get soy milk. You know? Mm-hmm. Now you can go to grocery stores and they have different varieties of non-dairy alternatives. There's almond milk, there's soy milk, there's coconut milk, and it's getting, you know, so it's I think it's just a matter of getting out of old habits. And instead of going and getting cow's milk, you know, go and purchase a non-dairy milk.
Yeah, there's no excuse that holds anymore. It's all out there. It's all easy. It's all available pretty much all over the United States. You mentioned your parents. What do they eat?
Well, my parents are not vegan, but they eat a lot less animal foods than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had a heart attack about 15 years ago, and when he was in the hospital, they were feeding him bacon and eggs.
Oh, I know that. Oh, is that crazy?
It's amazing. So that actually, I think, opened his mind to this idea that the doctor doesn't know everything.
Amen.
Yeah, and so my dad started reading books. He read Dean Ornish's book on reversing heart disease and has changed how he's eating. And my mother has also changed in a positive direction, and their health has improved because of it.
Oh, that's good news. Very good indeed. Yeah, it's crazy. I know that when I was in the hospital and I would talk to dietitians about what I wanted to eat and see what they were feeding people, cancer patients, bacon, like you said, and foods with sugar and sugar feeds cancer. It's just crazy. And these people, they have degrees and they were educated and they don't know anything.
It's really amazing. It's sort of the comeback and see us diet that they give them at hospitals. It's really unfortunate. And you know, I think the people that work in the hospitals are not bad people. They're just terribly misinformed, and they have bad habits, and they assume that this is the right way and the healthy way to eat when it is not. But again, there's starting to be more awareness about it, and even some doctors are now starting to speak out, and
right.
I'm hopeful that that this...
We just have a few seconds, Gene, so thank you so much for joining me, and it's all about food. You're so great, and you're doing great things. Thank you so much for that. And we're out of time, so thanks for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's all about food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and have a delicious week.